This is Money Talking from WNYC. Good morning, I'm Charlie Herman. With me, regular contributors Joan Osser with The New York Times and Rana Fruhar with Time Magazine. And let me start this morning with a number, $11 billion. That's the potential price tag for J.P. Morgan to settle scores of investigations and charges by various federal and state agencies into how the bank handled mortgage-backed securities before the financial crisis. Let me say that again, $11 billion. I want to put that in context. That's about how much money, how much profit Google made last year. It's 2.5 times the size of what BP paid to settle claims after the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. And Joe, there are so many issues that JP Morgan is dealing with here, a lot of investigations going on. When we hear $11 billion, does this really reflect the amount of damages that were incurred, or is this just a large sum of money? It's punitive, but it's not enough to actually put the bank out of business.
So let me give you a third statistic. $11 billion is about 2/4 of profit for J.P. Morgan. So there will be pain. Shareholders in particular will suffer. But, you know, it's not an insurmountable sum of money, and J.P. Morgan wouldn't be negotiating an $11 billion settlement if they didn't think they could handle it.
Also, you know, just to pick up on that, in terms of whether or not it's a lot of money, well, it's a sliver of what was lost, obviously, you know, from bad mortgages amongst people that actually lost their homes. It's also worth noting that banks make 40% of the corporate profits in this country. I mean, they employ about 6% of the people, but they make 40% of the profits. So, you know, $11 billion is really – it's not necessarily representative of the damages, and I actually don't think it's that much for a bank like
J.P. But who actually pays for this settlement?
Well, first of all, J.P. Morgan has all along been putting aside reserves. We don't really know how much for litigation and settlement. But everything else is it's going to come from the shareholders because it's going to reduce profit. There's just no – I want to say one thing – not necessarily in defense of J.P. Morgan, but it's worth remembering that although some of these mortgage-backed securities were originally J.P. Morgan securities, some of them are also from Bear Stearns and from Washington Mutual, two really damaged institutions that J.P. Morgan bought in no small part with the encouragement of the U.S. government that's now going to extract billions back.
So that's a good point.
Well, when you see these large fines that the bank could be paying, is this just the cost of doing business in a financial world that we're in, or does it actually act as a deterrent for banks to maybe not engage in some behavior? Where does it fall?
You know, I think the problem with fines as a deterrent is, well, what is it really deterring? You know, to me, a deterrent would be clear rules that say you cannot do this kind of trading, or if you do, it's not going to be within a federally insured institution. You know, we've talked about some of those issues on the show before, that we need a separation between commercial and investment banking. That, to me, is a deterrent because it's a clear rule. I'm not quite sure what an $11 billion fine is telling us. Is it telling us that if you pay enough money, you can get off the hook? Is it telling us that trading is bad? I mean, I'm just not sure what this all means.
You know, one thing it does signal is that the regulators are a lot tougher than they were even two or three years ago. Tom Curry is the new comptroller of the currency, which means he's the nation's primary bank regulator, and he is tough. One of the things that's happened to J.P. Morgan here is the embarrassment factor. It's not just the money. And the regulators, one of the things they've been saying across the board is to J.P. Morgan, your compliance officers aren't good enough. You don't have enough of them. Procedures that should be second nature to bankers, such as safeguards against money laundering, you know, they didn't do. And that's one of the things they're going to be paying money for.
Well, we've talked about this before when it comes to Wall Street investigations, that if you see a settlement, does this really satisfy the appetite of Main Street, as it were, that wants to see actual prosecutions of the people involved behind the things that happen?
I don't think it does. I think all it does is highlight, as Joe said, that this is only 2/4 of profits for this bank.
Well, I think people are actually fairly desensitized to this now, and they kind of just shrug their shoulders. I mean, I don't think there's an expectation anymore 5 years later that anybody's going to go to jail.
But if we're desensitized, when you see something this big, $11 billion, against the nation's largest bank, this possibility of $11 billion settlement, is this basically saying it's the final chapter in the history of the financial crisis, that, you know, we're closing the book, you know, we've got this big fine, it's time to move on?
I think that that's what the administration would like you to think, and that's what Washington would like you to think. But what it says to me is that, you know, scandals are supposed to be surprises. I don't think anybody was surprised by this.
You know, there will be there may not be more federal investigations, but one thing that will continue at least for the next 5, maybe 10 years is the fight by everybody over money. So one of the reasons J.P. Morgan's paying all this sum is because Fannie and Freddie are saying, you sold us bad mortgages. We want our money back. In fact, that kind of fight is going on among every institution, and that's not going to end anytime soon.
Well, let's take a look ahead to some of the other stories that we're watching this week. Joe, what are you paying attention to?
I'm looking at Alibaba. It's a very interesting Chinese company. It's actually a pretty large company. It's a business-to-business site, as they say. And they want to go public. And they've been negotiating for quite a while with the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, and they pulled out of those negotiations, and they decided to, instead to go public in New York. Why? Because in New York, they can be like Facebook, they can be like Google, they can be like all these internet companies where the founders have two classes of stock and they're able to retain control even though they don't own that larger piece of the company. In Hong Kong, you can't do that. So they don't want to be minority shareholders in their own company. They want to have control, and so they're coming to the U.S.
Rana, what are you watching?
Well, I'm looking at the shenanigans in Washington over the potential government shutdown, the debt ceiling debates. You know, it's just crazy that we're back where we have been for the last 3 years. And everybody expects that we're going to get a deal at the last minute. But, you know, if for any reason we weren't and we were to go into a situation by mid-October where we were actually to default on some of our debt, I'm very glad I have my mortgage locked in and that I own a car, because interest rates, I predict, would definitely react to that. If you look back, there was one other incident in history, a very tiny technical default on just a few treasury bills back in 1979. Interest rates went up and stayed up for about 6 months.
Well, we'll be watching where interest rates go and all the week's financial news at WNYC.org/business. You can also take this program with you as a podcast available on iTunes. Joan O'Sara with The New York Times and Rana Fruhar with Time Magazine. Thanks for joining.
Thank you.
I'm Charlie Herman. This is Money Talking from WNYC.